You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. It is just me today, I'm afraid. My lovely co-host, my new co-host, Mena Van Praagh, she's in the States teaching creative writing. So she's still furthering the book cause somewhere. But this is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. We've got interviews today with Black Country poet Liz Berry and author Laura Barnett. And my studio guest today is debut novelist Natasha Pulley. Hello, Natasha.
Hello.
We'll come back and give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But reading your CV, there's not much of it, because how old are you?
I'm 26.
Oh, you're 26 and a debut novelist already. Wow, that is young. Does that feel young?
It doesn't. It feels like well into my career path, unfortunately, so I'm not enjoying it.
Well, you part of your CV is about the time you spent at UEA and doing the MA. Was that integral to writing the novel? Could you have written the novel without doing the MA, the creative writing MA?
No way. I had the idea before I went, and they let me in on a short story version of what became the novel. But while I was there, what they taught me to do was write sentences, which is the number one important thing, definitely. I could not have written this book without the MA.
Because there's a lot of criticism been bandied about over the years towards creative writing MAs by actually some of the people who teach on creative writing MAs, that creative writing is something that can't be taught.
Well, I would say that it's very difficult to teach imagination. That is one of the things that tends to have to grow by itself. You can certainly put somebody in an environment in which it's easy to imagine, but you can certainly teach people how to write English grammatical sentences. And it's surprising how many people can't, how many writers are unsure about certain styles. And what a creative writing MA will teach you is how to write. It's not necessarily how to imagine storytelling, but they will certainly teach you how to write.
And how to lift your material, I suppose. You had an idea and they enabled you to lift that and develop it into a fully grown novel.
That's right. They're giving you the tools with which to make this something both commercially and academically viable, I would say.
And since you've had the novel published, you yourself have taught. Is that right?
Yes, no, that is right. I lived in Japan for a while, and while I was there, I taught half of the creative writing course at a university called Waseda in Tokyo.
So that must have been weird, being on the other side of the table and seeing the writing coming to you. As a tutor, can you see instantly who's got the potential?
You often can, but I would say that almost everyone has a basic grasp of storytelling, because everybody is told fairy tales, everybody knows stories, you watch films, everybody knows that this happens and then this happens and then this happens. A lot of it is just about teaching structure until it becomes this recognisable thing that we call a story. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk a lot about your story, but we're going to hear your first choice of music, which is Of Monsters and Men, King and Lionheart. Why this one?
I listened to this a lot when I was writing, and I think the relationship of King and Lionheart very well describes some of the characters in my book, actually.
Taking over this town, they should worry. But these problems aside, I think I taught you well.
That Just Fading Away is Of Monsters and Men, King and Lionheart, the first choice of my guest today, Natasha Pulley. Natasha studied English literature at Oxford University, and then after stints working at Waterstones and Cambridge University Press, she did the creative writing MA at UEA. The Watchmaker of Filigree Street, published this year, is her first novel. The New York Times called it an assured and absorbing debut. The Los Angeles Times described it as remarkable, and the Times Higher Education supplement said it was a brilliant novel in which fantasy punctuates history. Wow, Natasha, brilliant reviews. How did that feel?
Really good and very surprising, actually. I really didn't think it would get those sorts of reviews at all.
But stellar reviews, you know, looking, doing the research for this interview with you, just stellar, 4-5-star reviews consistently.
Yeah, shocked. Completely horizontal with shock.
And when I went down to London about 6 weeks ago, on billboards in tube stations, you must have seen this, well, big, big pictures of your book as well. Clearly the publisher got right behind it.
They really did. And I was very surprised because this all happened without my knowledge. And they invited me for this kind of what I thought was a very brief publicity meeting. And then they said, and of course there'll be posters on the tube. And I was like, there'll be what?
That's when you know you've made it, isn't it? When you see posters on the tube and you see somebody reading your book on the tube as well.
I've not seen anyone reading the book on the tube, but I have seen the posters. And when they first went up, I was in London and often on the Jubilee line and kind of dying a little bit with both embarrassment and kind of smugness whenever I saw one.
Well, so you should be. So tell us, The Watchmaker of Filigree Street, for those who haven't read it, briefly, what is it about?
It's about a watchmaker who remembers the future. He lives in London, in late Victorian London, the 1880s, and he lives just in the time when Irish Fenians are blowing up choice parts of London, and he's suspected of making one of the bombs.
And that's the content of the book, the style of it. How would you describe that? Because the reviews, again, were quite interesting. Steampunk was mentioned, magical realism. What would be your take? What would be your definition of...
So I've always called it historical fantasy, but I think steampunk fits as well, because steampunk, I think, at its heart is historical science fiction. The actual written style of it, though, is not Victorian at all. It's mostly modern diction, and that was a very deliberate choice.
And did you set out to write something that had that blend? You must have done, fact and fantasy, and why? Why? Because you do have mechanical octopi. No, it's one octopus. And things happen, and as a reader, you think, what? What was that? What went past me just then? So that was your intention?
Yeah, definitely. My intention was 90% historical accuracy and 10% weird stuff. And I think the reasoning behind that is, I think a lot of historical fiction is about reconstruction. It's about putting things together as they once looked and try to bring some very similitude back to something that is really now a ruin for us. Putting fantasy in that history is a lot like putting a new glass tower on an Anglo-Saxon church. It's not just about reconstruction, it's about putting something new on something familiar, and I really love that idea.
Was that to make us look anew at what was old?
Yeah, and one of the things that I wanted to do was really blend what you know to be real and what is fantasy. So I tried to make it a fairly blurry line. And in fact, as it turned out, the line is at the top of Filigree Street. Filigree Street is a fictional street. The rest of the place is real. The rest of it is real London. But yeah, certainly, that was an aim.
And did you set yourself rules within that yes, I'll have fantasy in here, but only these things can happen?
The rule is to stick to what the Victorians believed to be physically true at the time. And one of their overriding theories was this theory of the luminiferous ether, the light-bearing ether. And I tried to stick within the physics that is implied by that theory.
Wow, so you know a lot about this theory now.
Well, I used to write blurbs for scientific reprints of 19th century physics books. So I ended up reading a lot of those.
And where did the idea for this story come from? Because it is so unusual and so different. I was saying to you off air, I opened it not really knowing anything about it. I didn't want to read the blurb. And you're taken into this amazingly recognisable but different world. And it's very exciting as a reader. Where did the idea come to you that this was what you were going to write about?
I think it's a real mishmash of stuff, actually. When I started, I was reading a lot of Sherlock Holmes and watching a lot of Japanese sci-fi. And I think the book is a natural conglomeration of those things.
And I suppose there is this trend. You mentioned Sherlock Holmes there, the book, and I suppose thinking about the TV adaptation of Sherlock, there is this trend now to sort of update, as it were, or give a little bit of zip to these Victorian stories.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think this is a trend of storytelling in general. We will always renew stories. And I think often you look at a lot of modern Hollywood stories and they are just reworked fairy tales a lot of the time, and especially in fantasy. Like, we're retelling the same stories again and again and again. But that isn't detrimental to narrative art at all. I think that's just how narrative works.
And are you a fan as a reader of the genre of magical realism?
Magical realism, it so depends on what you mean by that, because often magical realism is just a very literary way of saying very good fantasy. So I'm certainly an Angela Carter fan. I'm reading a lot of her stuff at the moment. I think magical realism is an interesting tag because it tends to mean very good, very political fantasy a lot of the time. I think some of the things we associate with magical realism, like Salman Rushdie and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, they tend to be things that would be very difficult to say in just literary realism from the politics and the country that they're coming from. And so it goes off into these magical metaphors, and that makes magical realism. Whereas I feel like what I tend to write and what we often call magical realism is actually just decent fantasy.
Well, we're going to come back to so much of what you just said then, because there is that element of politics in your book, and I want to explore that with you and ask you about the research you did. We're going to hear now, though, from Laura Barnett. Mena Van Prague spoke to Laura. Laura is an arts journalist, theatre critic, and she writes regularly for The Guardian, The Daily Telegraph and Time Out. Her first novel, The Versions of Us, published earlier this year, received outstanding reviews and is being translated into 20 languages. When Mena met her at her home in South London, she asked Laura to describe The Versions of Us to her.
So The Versions of Us is the love story about one couple, Eva and Jim, but it's an unconventional love story because we see their relationship play out in three different ways. Starting in Cambridge in the 50s and moving right up to the present day, we see these three different trajectories all based on a decision they make in one moment, basically in 1958.
Was there a particular thing that inspired the story?
The idea of writing three versions of one couple's life from beginning to end came to me really one morning, almost out of the blue. I don't think I dreamt it, but I woke up thinking, this is what I want to write next. I'd been writing fiction for some time, probably about 15, 20 years by that point, so since a teenager. And I knew I needed to find a new project that really got me excited, that really sort of made me want to jump out of bed in the morning and get writing. And that was the idea that came to me. And it's really only looking back that I think it must have partly been inspired by the fact that I'd got married myself about 3 months before I had this idea. I guess I was thinking about how random it was that I'd met my husband. We met at a party in Edinburgh, and you know, there are a million reasons why I might not have gone to the party, why he might not have done, or we could have each been attached to somebody else, or they could, you know, it might just not work between us. I guess subconsciously I was thinking about that, about these tiny decisions that we make that don't seem significant at the time that then have a huge impact on the people we meet and the choices that we make and the lives that we live.
And one of the things that I adore about the book is that it's not just one of those typical romances where you think, well, if we hadn't have met, then everything would have been awful. Each version is so compelling because it's not what you'd expect. When they meet, doesn't lead to what you might think will happen. How did that evolve for you?
I knew I wanted to write about love in a realistic way. In thinking about the three versions of one relationship, one romance, I was clear pretty early on that I didn't want it to be the conventional kind of Hollywood idea. I did feel initially that there would probably be a sense as I wrote that Eva and Jim were sort of meant to be, or that the versions in which they found each other early on would be the better versions, but that wasn't how it evolved as I wrote. I was clear that I didn't want there to be this idea that only one of the versions was the valid one and that the other two were wasted lives or lives that hadn't been quite as fulfilled. So yeah, it was a sense of wanting to explore the reality of romance, not just that shallow idea that we have peddled to us through films or whatever. Wanting to go a bit deeper and to explore the compromises and the disappointments and the difficulties of love, as well as its great passion and its wonderful optimism and everything else that it brings us.
The book, in a way, it's quite complex in terms of the plot, and you have these three versions that you're weaving together. But the way you're talking, it wasn't as though you plotted everything out and you knew exactly what was going to happen. You let the story also take you places.
I did, exactly. Having woken up that morning with this idea, I sat down and started to think who the two characters were. I sketched out three versions of their story really just a paragraph per version, just to get a sense of how they would differ and to make sure that from the beginning I was sort of setting out with a road map, almost like I was going to the same place, but I needed three ways to get there. But they weren't long plans. I didn't, you know, plan chapter by chapter or anything like that. And it's interesting because that's something that I've evolved over the years, because I wrote two novels before this one. But what that did teach me was that it's really important to be surprised by your characters. I'm sure some people do it brilliantly and sit down and plan everything, and that's great. But for me, I need to leave them room to make their own decisions within a scene, because life is constantly surprising, and I think fiction should feel like that too. I think if I knew exactly where I was going from the beginning, I'd be bored, basically, and I think the reader would feel that. So I did leave it quite open.
So you wrote it that we'd get a piece of version one, a piece of version two, a piece of version three, and then, you know, a little bit would end, and then you bring in another version, and then we'd be introduced sometimes to something completely new, or there'd be something you'd maybe suggested at, and then it would come forth. There was a lot of great subtlety and a lot of extremely beautiful sentences. How much did you edit, and how much did it just all come out?
I did a lot of editing, yeah. I don't want to give the impression that I just sat down and wrote it and it sort of appeared out of nowhere. The first draft was quite rapid, but unlike with the other two books that I'd written before, where I think I wrote them and I hadn't yet learned that so much of writing is rewriting. I can't remember who said that, someone infinitely more famous than me. So with this, I was clear that I would need to look at it again. I would need to canvas opinion of people I trusted. So what I did really, when I'd got the book as close to finish as I possibly could and I felt that it was ready to be seen, I curated a little group of about eight friends and colleagues and associates, people who I knew wouldn't lie to me, wouldn't just feel they had to tell me it was good. And I made sure they were all quite different kinds of readers. And after a couple of months, they all came back to me and they were all very positive, which is great, but they also had really useful feedback. So then I did a good 6-8 months of rewriting and really working on those sentences kind of line by line, taking out all the cliches, really thinking hard about what I meant and making sure I wasn't just reaching for some easy phrase when there was something slightly more specific, and trying to bring in as much detail as I could.
And did you have a favourite character? Not necessarily one that you liked the best, but one that you enjoyed writing about the most.
I have a real affection for Miriam Edelstein, who is Eva's mum. As we learn in the book, she was born in Vienna and fled pregnant with Eva in the late 30s as a Jewish refugee. And it was interesting because I loved writing her, and I loved writing about the house in Highgate in North London where Eva grows up, and about Jacob, her stepfather, as well. And it was only when I finished that I realised how much of my own story was in there, specifically my late step-grandmother. So I think the affection I felt for Miriam was probably partly also the affection I'd felt for Anita coming through without me even realising, which is quite strange.
Can you tell us a bit about your writing day?
I'm a morning person, so I get up reasonably early and I perform the extremely long commute of walking up the stairs to my attic. So I start about 9 o'clock and I write till lunchtime. I'm quite disciplined about it. I don't have my phone near me. I don't check my email unless it's really not going very well and I need a distraction. I don't answer the phone. My husband's under strict instructions not to bother me. So I drink lots of coffee and I sit and write. And then at lunchtime, I either go back to it or I go and do some journalism or do an interview like this one, or you spend my afternoon in some other way, because I don't write as well in the afternoon. Sometimes I go back and edit. It's very intense as well, writing. It's a kind of concentration that is very different to, say, when I was a journalist and I was in the office. And, you know, we all have those kind of dead hours in the afternoon where you don't do very much other than check your email or whatever, whereas you can't really do that with writing fiction. You have to be very focused, and it's tiring.
And what would you say is the most enjoyable thing and the most challenging thing that you find about writing?
The most enjoyable thing is having the opportunity to create a world that is entirely invented but feels as real as the one that I'm living in. And I think when it's going well, I experience this very strange sensation where I can be walking around in the physical world, but my head is just elsewhere. Probably a kind of madness in that way. I really find that addictive, and I mean, it's what excites me as a reader. As a reader, I love to escape into the writer's, the world that the writer has created for me. So to have the opportunity to do that myself as a writer is really exciting, and that's what keeps me coming back to it. I think the most challenging thing is, I mentioned this a bit earlier, but is making sure that what you're saying is fresh and different. I think because we're so saturated with information and words that sometimes the way of phrasing something comes to you and then you realise later that it's a complete cliche and that, you know, you've read it somewhere else. Staying fresh and original and finding your own way of saying things is quite a challenge.
Can you tell us a little bit about your next book, or would you rather not talk about it?
So my next book is called Greatest Hits, and it's got another female character at its core, but it's really just her story. She's not sharing it with her partner. So it's about a singer-songwriter in her 60s who's been very successful, but for reasons that become clear through the book, has turned her back on music about 10 years before and is now, only now, coming back to making music. It's set over one day. She's hosting a party in the evening, and during the day she's in her studio at home listening to her old songs to choose tracks for a greatest hits record. And so each track that she plays becomes a short story about how and when that song was written. So we learn her biography through the music that she's written.
And I'm struck by the versions of us being a whole lifetime of all of these characters, and this is set in one day. How did that come to you?
Well, it's one day, but it's one day in which we experience a whole lifetime. I'm really interested in the idea of constraint as a writer, of imposing constraint on yourself, whether it's the kind of structure that I played with in the versions of us, or whether it's just being set over one day. And I'm a huge fan of Virginia Woolf, and I reread Mrs. Dalloway recently, and I just thought, my goodness, you know, it's one day, but everything is in there, a whole life is there. It's that kind of William Blake idea of like there being a grain of sand, but the whole world being in it. There's another novel I absolutely adore, is called Breathing Lessons by Anne Tyler, who is my absolute heroine, literary heroine. And that, again, is set over one day. I can see where my inspirations have come from now. With a couple driving to a funeral, and in real time, not that much happens, but everything happens as well, because she sifts underneath all the layers that underpin their marriage and shows us who they are and who they've been, who they're going to be. I find that really exciting. I love novels that take a long view of a whole life, but I also love novels that just give us one moment or one day. So I'm trying to do both.
That was Laura Barnett, author of The Versions of Us, talking to Mena Van Praagh. You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105, and my studio guest is Natasha Pulley. Laura was talking there, Natasha, about letting the story take her places. Did you find that, writing at The Watchmaker, Filigree Street?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, just like Laura, I didn't really plot. And I think what she was saying about letting the characters have space is very important, because if you plot everything wholly, it implies that you have a perfect knowledge of all the permutations and possibilities of what might happen. And of course, just like in real life, you don't when you write a novel. And I think it's better to decide scene by scene where, realistically, things must go.
So was it that you'd be writing and suddenly you think, oh, that could happen? You know, it would be literally in the moment of writing.
Yeah, definitely. And often it was quite unexpected because, again, as you do in real life, you think in any given scenario that you would do one particular thing. And of course, as soon as you're landed in that scenario, you would do something quite different, because everything around you makes much more sense when you're in it.
And she was also talking about wanting to say something fresh and different there. Was that part of the reason behind your writing, something really very, very different?
I don't think I set out to write anything fresh at all. It was just the story of the people I happen to be interested in. And annoyingly, they happen to be imaginary.
But you have real life in there, and I wanted to ask you about that, because you talked about the bombings in London, many of which, those really happened.
Yeah, they did. It was in the early 1880s. An Irish group called Clan na Gael were getting increasingly angry about what looked like the increasing impossibility of home rule. And a very militant arm of them began to blow up bits of London, and they managed to get a bomb inside the Houses of Parliament. I don't think anyone was hurt. They also threw a bomb in through the downstairs windows of the Home Office, and they did blow up Scotland Yard.
That was the most shocking thing, that I really had no idea about that. Really, that's not taught at all. That was an amazing piece of information when I read that.
Yeah, it's why we've got new Scotland Yard now. They blew up the old one.
And how did you go about researching this?
In an extremely unprofessional and haphazard way, I think. I had the characters and a bit of the story a long time before I really did any research at all. I was very lazy. The more I looked into it, the more interesting the Irish bombing campaign was. And I actually moved the date of the story back by about 10 years to fit it. So it was all very kind of up in the air and malleable when I was writing.
You moved your story back to fit it. In terms of the actual facts, did you feel you could take any liberty with them, or did you leave them as they were?
No, they really do stand as set historical pillars for me. I really try and change things as little as possible. One thing that did change slightly was the opening date of the Japanese show village in Knightsbridge. I moved it forward by a few months, but I think that's the only thing I changed.
I don't think anybody's going to quibble with you in that. And even that, a Japanese show village.
I'm just waiting for someone to say, well, by the way, it didn't open until September.
but the fact that it's there, again, there was a Japanese show village at the end of the 19th century.
That's right. There was. It was in a building called Humphreys Hall, which is just on the corner of Hyde Park at the top of Knightsbridge. And it was part of the Great Exhibition. And I think what it is really is evidence of this Victorian fascination with all things to do with the Far East. They loved Japanese culture. And what they did was they brought about 150 Japanese artisans and their family to live in this place, almost like a living museum. It cost a few pence to get in. It was immensely popular. And I think over the 3 or 4 years that it existed, they had millions of visitors.
It's kind of very hard to imagine now, just Victorians wandering around a village that Japanese people were living their lives in the middle of London.
I know, it's just this incredible microcosm of the old Tokyo. I was amazed when I found that it existed.
You must have thought, what a gift.
Well, it was a particular gift because I already had a Japanese watchmaker who lived in Knightsbridge before I knew about the village, did a bit of reading about Knightsbridge at the time, and found, I think as you often do with historical fiction, if you've got an idea basically right, that there was a lot of Japanese stuff going on in the same area at the time.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. One of the many reasons to read the book, for the description of the show village, which absolutely leaps off the pages. We're going to play another of your tracks now. This is Hopeless Wanderer by Mumford & Sons. Why have you chosen this one?
Because I am also a hopeless wanderer.
Heard my voice. I came out of the woods by choice.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
And our studio guest today is author, debut novelist, Natasha Pulley, debut novelist. So it was your debut novel. What did you learn writing this novel? Would you write your second one in a completely different way?
I think I'm going to try and write it in just the same way, but a little bit more efficiently.
Why? What was inefficient about the way you wrote this one?
I didn't really put in a plot till the very end of the writing process, which I suspect was a bad idea. It was very much an afterthought. I think we'd done about a year of editing, and my editor sort of nudged me and went, probably something should happen in this.
Because you'd written short stories before, so it is quite a step up from writing a short story to a novel.
Well, I had written short stories before, but I'm not a terribly good short story writer. The short stories that I had written were really just chapters of novels, rather than fully formed and interesting short stories in their own respects. And while I was writing those, I was always writing much longer fiction at the same time. So I feel like, even though if you look at my publication history, short stories come first, I've always really been a novel writer.
You've always wanted to be a novel writer.
Yes,
you've always been sort of scratching at the door.
That's right.
And what was the process in terms of getting an agent for you? Did that happen quite quickly?
This is really the reason that I would so champion the creative writing schools. If you go to a good creative writing school, they will introduce you to at least 10 agents. You'll speak to at least 3 publishers while you're there. And how it happened for me was that the agent who I eventually signed with came to talk to some BA students at UEA in the first November that I was there. And I thought, oh, I'll go along because it's the first one. And she talked about wanting some historical fiction and wanting some fantasy. So I went up to her afterwards and went, well, you know, I've written this thing. And she said, yeah, send it when you've finished. I thought, oh, OK, well, she's being polite and lying. But 6 months later, when I finished, I did send it in. 2 days later, come to the office.
Wow. Wow, she knew. She knew straight away.
Yeah.
Well, well, congratulations. But we're going to come and talk to you about your second novel and whatever pressure you may be feeling with regard to that. We're going to hear from Liz Berry first. Liz Berry's debut collection of poetry entitled Black Country was a Poetry Book Society recommendation, received a Somerset Maugham Award and won the Forward Prize for Best First Collection in 2014. It was also chosen as a Book of the Year by numerous national newspapers. Liz now lives in Birmingham and was born in the Black Country. When I met her, I asked her how important where she came from was to her.
For me, it's something that's really important and also endlessly fascinating. Interestingly, most of the poems are written when I was living away from the Black Country. And being apart from it, I felt a sort of lover's longing for it. I saw it through new eyes and I appreciated its language, its history, its landscape, the way it was in a process of transformation. And I found that it haunted my writing more and more, and I wanted to explore it, explore family stories and go back and dig into the place and see what it meant to me and what it meant to all the people that come from there.
It's a place that often gets a bad press, the Midlands, isn't it?
It is, and I think particularly the West Midlands, Birmingham and the Black Country. It was a really important industrial area, and often areas that have been really important for industry and mining. Once that's left, they get bad press, they get neglected, they get run down. I think it's really easy to forget that there are people there leading rich and interesting lives with very proud histories. They bring their family up there. There's a fascinating dialect at work there. Probably the Black Country in Birmingham, they're those places people think they know a lot about without ever having actually been there.
So what were you looking for when you were looking in it? Because you... It's not the most beautiful part of the country, though there are parts of it that are quite pretty. What were you actually sort of digging down and trying to find?
The Black Country's got this amazing story of industrial wonder and decline. It was the heart of the Industrial Revolution, a place of invention and industry and immense toil. And then that all changed, a gradual process of decline, and that in itself is really fascinating to me, the stories and the histories of the people that were part of that process. I'm fascinated by the way nature's reclaimed bits of the Black Country, the bits people might think of as being the unbeautiful bits, the old factories, the old mines, the old steelworks, where nature's now creeping in again and grown over and reclaiming, and that's something that I'm really interested in. I love the dialect and the accent. And once I started digging into those words, I discovered there was this fascinating word hoard. These wonderful, rich, gritty, exotic words. And it was just delightful to be able to play with them and use them in the poems.
Well, let's talk about the accent, because, again, that gets a bit of a bad press, doesn't it? But there's a sing-song element to the accent. Do you think that influenced you in your poetry?
It does get a really bad press, doesn't it? I think year after year, it's voted the least lovely accents in the British Isles. And I think that's a terrible shame. I think it's got a great sound to it. Like you say, there's an element of the sing-song or the musical to it. It's quite guttural. There's rich and quite unexpected dialect words in there, lovely sort of thick vowels and pronunciations. And I wanted to reclaim some of that, really, as the stuff of poetry. There's been lots of dialect writing over the years, but lots of it's been comic or for narrative purposes. And I suppose I wanted to do something different with it. I wanted to take the language that my family had spoken and show people that that could be the stuff of lyric poetry, that it could be a beautiful, eloquent language.
It is hard writing in dialect, isn't it? Because you want it to be accessible, but you want to be true to the dialect itself. How did you tread some sort of central line there?
Well, that's a really good question, because it's a hard balance to find. I think two things are important. One was that the poem should always allow the reader in, even readers that have never heard the dialect. And that means perhaps just using the odd word here or there, giving a suggestion of the voice without the full phonetics. Also, in the poems where I think it's important that the word be known to non-dialect speakers, there's a little gloss at the bottom, so you don't have to look too hard to find the meaning of the word. And I found that people have taken great pleasure in that, in discovering these new, unusual words. But it's always been so important to me that poems invite readers in and welcome readers in and allow them to be part of the experience, a part of the story that's being told.
And are there some, because of the dialect, that come alive more when they're performed?
I think there are, but I think that's often the case with poems. Some poems just lend themselves to being heard. Poetry started out as an oral art, an oral tradition, and I think when someone reads well, or there's a great connection with the audience, it can be a really exciting experience. And I think especially with poems that have an element of dialect or something musical about them, they really do come alive in performance.
Do you remember the first time you felt that connection with a poem, either one you read or one you heard?
Oh, when I was a little girl, we had a really beautiful book of poems called The Swinging Rainbow, and it was full of everything from Dylan Thomas, T.S. Eliot, folk poems, playground rhymes, right through to more contemporary poems. And we used to read it with my mum and learn some of the poems off by heart. And I remember just feeling like there was something magical in that book, something I couldn't really describe. Poems that moved me and unsettled me and made me feel that the world was full of possibilities. So if I think of when I first sort of discovered poetry and that experience, that connection, it's probably with that book.
And your first collection won the Forward Prize. How important was that to you?
Oh, it was utterly thrilling in every way. It was so unexpected. It felt like a lovely validation of the work and of the poems. I think at the time I said, what a beautiful surprise, and it really was.
Does it put pressure on you, though, for a second collection?
Well, I think everybody talks about the difficult second album, don't they? And it's probably been a strange experience for me, because just before Black Country was published, my first son was born. So it felt like lots of huge changes happened at once. I became published, I had a little boy. Life just changed in so many ways. But that also frees you to write something new and do something new and be a bit braver and try different things. Take some of the music and the language that was part of the Black Country book, some of those stories, and take them to a new place.
And I suppose having an award validates you in that you can say now, you know, I am a poet.
It does, although I always still feel a bit shy about it. Sometimes, you know, if people ask me what I do, I say, oh, you know, I'm a primary school teacher, or I stay at home with my little boy. I'm much shyer, I think, about owning it.
Could you read a poem for us?
This poem's called Homing, and I always like to think of it as a love poem to the accent and dialect of the Black Country. Homing. For years, you kept your accent in a box beneath the bed, the lock rusted shut by hours of elocution. How now, brown cow, the teacher's ruler across your legs. We heard it escape sometimes, a guttural or on the phone to your sister, saft or blart, to a taxi driver, unpacking your bags from his boot. I loved its thick drawl. G's that rang. Clearing your house. The only thing I wanted was that box. Jemmy Dalpin. To let years of lost words spill out. Bibble. Fiddle. Tie. Wum. Vels ferrous as nails. Consonants you could lick the coal from. I wanted to swallow them all. The pits, railways, factories thunking and clanging the night shift. The red brick back to back you were born in. I wanted to forge your voice in my mouth. A blacksmith's furnace. Shout it from the roofs. Send your words like pigeons. Fluttering for home.
Thank you. Do you know what? That rings a real bell for me, because I'm from Yorkshire, but I've lost my accent over the years. And I remember the moment when I thought it would probably be wise to start losing it, when somebody took the mickey out of me at university. But I think now we are celebrating accents more. Does it feel that way to you?
I hope so. Interestingly, that poem often rings a bell with people. I think it's about the Black Country accent and dialect, but it could be about any accent that you've had and lost. And I suppose it's about home and longing for home and identity. And I hope that we are a little bit prouder of our accents now. I know certainly they're starting to seep into the radio and TV a little bit more, which is brilliant to hear, and I think really inspiring for young people who are coming from various regions and out into the big wide world.
And what's your favourite Black Country word?
Oh, I think it's probably the word tranquilments, which means ornaments, you know, the little china shepherdesses and bits and bobs that nans might have. And for me, I love it because tranquilments, it's that perfect mix of the word tranquility and ornaments. It seems to sum up everything about them perfectly.
Ah, tranquilments there. That's poet Liz Berry talking about her collection, The Black Country. I know she was saying there, Natasha Pulley, that quite rightly that the Black Country accent often gets voted as the least lovable. I could have sat and listened to Liz all day.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I wish she'd just do a recording of her reading the phone book.
And of course, when you're writing, you're very aware of language and every word and dialogue in particular. Your characters speak in different ways?
Well, in prose, in an ordinary novel that is not hyperliterary, I find it fairly annoying when an accent is spelled out phonetically because it looks so different on the page and it doesn't sound that strange when you hear it. If you hear a Black Country accent, it just sounds like a Black Country accent. If you hear Scottish, it sounds just Scottish. Whereas if you try and write that on a page, and I think Dickens does this a lot, very irritatingly, it's alienised in a way that it really shouldn't be. So one of the things that I would try to do is bring out maybe some of the words that are being used, some of the phrasing, but certainly not go into phonetics in any kind of meaningful way.
I think the tradition has changed, hasn't it, slightly? Because I think in Wuthering Heights, for example, there's lots of Yorkshire dialect in there.
Yeah.
It slows you down as a reader.
It does slow you down, and there's no need. They're speaking the same words. They're just using different intonations and slightly different phonetics. You know what people are saying to you in person. It's relatively easy. Often it's indecipherable if it's phonetically written down in a book. I really don't like that. I'd much prefer just to see the phrasing coming through in a very natural way. As I say, in an ordinary, unliterary novel, you can do amazing experimental things.
Because you have a Japanese character in your book.
Yes.
But you don't make him speak in a kind of allo allo Japanese style.
No. Yes, I've never heard a Japanese person say allo allo. He speaks English with a Lincolnshire accent because he's learned English from his housemate who's from Lincolnshire. So he doesn't really speak Japanese at all in the book. You hear a couple of words, but that's all.
I can't decide whether you made it easier for yourself or harder for yourself. Just a challenge. It's a challenge. Okay, well, let's talk about this difficult second album that Liz was talking about,
the
difficult second collection. Where are you up to with your second novel?
So the second novel was contracted at the same time as the first. It should be out in 2017. And I had a rather horrible experience of opening the Word document because it was already written. Yeah, it was already written at the time that Watchmaker was given over to Bloomsbury. And at the time, it was by far the better of the two. Opened up the Word document, I think, in July, looked at it and went, oh my God, what have you done? It's dreadful. So I'm now in the process of rewriting it.
Why did you think that? Is that because going through the process of editing the first novel, you've learned a lot and maybe it feels too wordy now or too self-explanatory?
When I opened it, the character felt like a caricature. And I'm actually really pleased because it means that I improved in the 2 years between writing it and opening the document again. And I learned so much about being subtle and being careful in the editing process of The Watchmaker. I've got a fantastic editor, and she taught me a great, great deal.
That is good because, yes, as you say, you've learnt without really realising.
Yeah.
And so it's all gone
in
there.
So there was a moment of horror and then I was like, oh, this means I'm a bit better than I thought.
Does that mean the word count will go down?
I'm hoping it will mean it goes up, because it came in rather short, about 75,000, and Watchmaker, I think, is about 110,000, and I would like the next one to come in at about the same, so I want to expand and make things much more detailed.
And will it be in the same genre?
It will be in the same genre. It will be historical fantasy, but it's going to be quite different. It's set in Peru. It's about a gardener who goes into the Amazon to retrieve quinine bark for the treatment of malaria.
Wow. Okay,
thank you.
Yeah, you got me already. And what about the third? Do you think about that? How far ahead do you have to think?
Well, I've written I've written a third one that's quite different, and I'm also partway through a Watchmaker sequel, which I would prefer to see published first, if that's possible. So there are two on the back burners.
And are you keen to shake off this debut novelist tag, or is it a nice tag to have?
Oh, no, I'm rather enjoying it, I have to say. It's very lovely.
It does sound very nice. And Laura was talking about, earlier, Laura Barnett was talking about her writing routine. She's a morning person, she gets up, she does it all in the morning. Do you have a routine?
I certainly do at the moment, and I think mine is very similar to hers. I roll out of bed and start writing over a big cup of coffee, definitely. But I do write all through the day. And I will have a sort of slower period in the afternoon, but then I often get going again in the evening, because I think that's when, once you're a bit tired, you stop worrying so much about whether this sentence or that is completely perfect, and you start just worrying about what happens. And that is a very good state of mind to be in. It means you can write a lot and write fast. And once I've done that, I'll come back the next day and start editing, and I'll often cut a lot of those words, but the worth of them is not lost.
And where do you see yourself? Oh, it's like a job interview, isn't it? Where would you see yourself in 5 years' time? I mean, this is you now. You're set up as a writer. What would you have hoped to achieve in 5 years?
I'm really not sure, but what I would like to do is spend some time going to the places that the next few books go to. And as I said in the second one, it goes to Peru and right into the Amazon. I would love to do that. There's another one that's set partially in Denmark. So I'd love to.
I'm liking your style.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. So I'd love to go to Denmark and learn some Danish properly, to not just be a tourist in these places, to actually live and learn. Because that did me a world of good in Japan, and it would be great to repeat that experience and pour it into the fiction.
I think you need to decide your country beforehand and then set your... Oh, so I'd like to go to Australia, so I'll set...
Yeah. No, I think that might be a fine plan. Yes, Venice is very beautiful, I must say.
Absolutely, yes. If you need anyone to carry your bags, let us know. Oh, well, thank you so much for coming into Bookmark today. Good luck with the writing. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
It's been an absolute pleasure being here. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, we're going to come back... And you're going to play your last choice of music in just a moment. Next Bookmark, which goes out in October, Men of Prague will be back with me. Our studio guest will be Joanne Lindberg. She's a friend of the show. We've spoken to Joanne before because she's written memoir, but this time she'll be here to talk about her new novel called A Want of Kindness, about Queen Anne, which I'm reading at the moment, very much enjoying. I'll also have interviews with Jonathan Topman and Mary Livingston about a new magazine called The Fenland Read. Jonathan is the Fenland Poet Laureate. And also chatting to Nigel Lamore Gordon about his novel set in the 1960s. He himself is a child of the 60s, a former friend of Mick Jagger, so we'll be talking about that. He does remember some of it, apparently. Yes, I know. So your last track to play out with... and I should say, any old bookmarks that you want to listen to, all the old episodes are up on the Cambridge 105 website. That's cambridge105.fm. They should all be available as podcasts, so do download them. So we'll play out with your last track, Natasha, which is Pride of the Summer by Runrig. Why this one?
I was brought up on Runrig and I love them, and I think they're not heard enough anymore.
Agreed.